going to be muting people by default, just, you know, as a default setting, but I will ask you to please unmute in order to make comments, ask questions. I much prefer if comments and questions are allowed as opposed to writing them into the chat. It's challenging to follow the chat while also speaking. So I much prefer it that way. I want to thank Zeifmans for hosting these classes for years and years, and God willing, we will be back there, hopefully even by the series in May. Who knows? That would be nice. Learning in person, not to mention being able to enjoy their lunch instead of, you know, what I'm bringing from home, always a bonus. Also want to thank Shari Shamayim as well as the Bayit for co-presenting this class with me. I greatly appreciate that. And this session is dedicated with the following donations from our Day of Giving that we held in July, Julius Kuhl, as well as Rebecca and Burl Nadler. So thank you very much. Of course, it is also November 11th, Remembrance Day. You can't see it because of the angle, but yes, the poppy is here. I think it's important that we take a moment, you know, we did at 11 o'clock, but that we take a moment as well to remember those who fell and those who risked their lives. You know, it's sort of a cliche that people say for the sake of the freedoms that we have, and freedom isn't free, but it's not just about freedom. It's about literally life and death. And particularly within the Jewish community, to recognize all that they did that we've directly benefited from. So we honor them today. And I mentioned this before we started, if you want to get a credit letter after the series is over, right? We're doing them after the series, not after each session. If you want to get a credit letter for having been here, it's really important that I have not only your sign-in, but also your email address. So what I need you to do is send that to me in the chat. In the event, if you're already on our email list, it means I have your email address. Then you don't need to put that in. If you've updated your email address, if you want us to use a different email address, you gotta please put that in the chat. If I don't have it, I will not use it. You can do it as a private message to me, and that's just fine. I see people have been putting in their names. That's very useful, obviously. Finally, as we get started, I'm gonna note a particular book. The book is called Heviani Chadarav. And this book came out, I think about a month, 6 weeks ago, something like that in Israel. And what it is essentially a collection of articles about all issues COVID, from rabbis who answered halachic questions since the beginning of the pandemic. It's just article after article after article, indexed by topic. So when I knew I was going to speak about COVID cancellations, I actually have a PDF of this book. The book is 600 and something pages. So I printed out just the part that deals with financial issues as a result of COVID. You're not going to be able to see it really on there, but this is 100 and something pages of material just on the various problems that came up due to COVID in terms of canceled contracts and all the permutations thereon. There's a lot of material on this. The book, again, is called Heviani Chadarav. I'm actually going to write the name into the chat. PDFs of it are available online. I'm not really sure, though, about the ethics of Delany. I'm not sure whether the publishers had that in mind. I don't know. Someone got a PDF somehow. But in any case, the name of it is there in the chat. It is Hebrew. That's why I put it in Hebrew. On there, transliterating into English isn't going to help anybody. Okay. So let's get started on our topic. I'm going to put in the chat once again the link for the source sheet for anyone who didn't get it off of my original email. We have a lot to talk about under the banner of COVID cancellations, ethics, and law. Here we go. If you look at the source sheet, you see I gave you three questions to start with. First one, not COVID related. My child was enrolled in a summer overnight camp for which I prepaid in order to lock in a discount. I thought I was smart. A fire destroyed the camp in March. The camp will not function this summer. Am I entitled to a full refund? I'm asking this question on two levels. One, basic civil law, and two, Jewish law. What would you say from a civil law perspective? I paid the money ahead of time. The camp expected to run. And then the camp is suddenly no longer able to run. What am I entitled to? The camp should what? Sorry?
Insurance, and you should get your money back.
Right. The camp should have insurance, and I should get my money back. Okay.
You're not going to get service. There's no way the camp can provide the service for which the deposit was paid.
Right. You're not getting the service that you paid for, right? This is called frustration of contract. We're going to have to come back to that. Good. Simple and straightforward? Almost. I'll just add a quirk, which we're going to also come back to. The camp, during that period before the fire, actually built new bunks, thinking that they were going to have more kids. They invested. What happens to their investment? Miriam says insurance. But what happens to their investment if the insurance for some reason isn't going to cover it? Now what do you do? So we're going to have to talk about this. But that's question number one. Question number two makes it COVID-related. My child was enrolled in a summer overnight camp for which I prepaid in order to lock in a discount. COVID canceled the camp season by order of the provincial government. Camp's still there. Law says you can't use it. Am I entitled to a full refund? Now what would you say, under a secular law perspective? Mm-hmm. Maybe.
I'm also not sure what kind of insurance coverage.
Is this interruption service?
But is it covered?
Right. The fire, by the way, is also a force majeure. It's also an act of God.
Right. Fire may also be, depending on how it started. But, Eddie, what were you saying?
There's business interruption insurance.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it's all it'll all be taken care of. Okay. Let's move to point three, and then we're going to go further. Point three really isn't a question for everybody, but it's a note that we're going to hopefully touch on before we're done, which is refunding all of the camp tuition may bankrupt the camp. So, again, assuming that we're not living in a world in which insurance takes care of everything, at the least, they will need to release some employees. Do I have an obligation to forgive some or all of my right to a refund in order to help them out, to be a nice guy? That's going to be our third point that we'll have to deal with. So I began with source number one, which is a quote from an article by Usher Weiss in that book that I mentioned, Heviani Chadarav. Because some people have joined more recently, I'm going to once again put the link in the chat for the source sheet. Rav Usher Weiss, for those who are not familiar, is a leading authority in Jewish law in Israel today. Especially in terms of very practical issues like this. And he's writing about, in the context of a ruling on a particular case, but what he says relates to all the things we're going to discuss today. I'm going to read aloud my English translation because we won't have enough time for me to read the original Hebrew and the English, but you have the original there for authenticity purposes as well. He says, "We are dealing with financial law. And what is unique in financial law is that the answers are never explicit and defined in relation to real-life questions, meaning you work with precedents, you try to match your precedent with the case at hand, but they don't match up cleanly. There is always room to question and challenge that perhaps the case does not fully resemble the evidence that you're bringing for a particular ruling. And all such questions, it is never possible to make a clear and decisive ruling, and the authority must weigh matters on a scale with two values as a light for his path, straight intellect and the traits of justice and compassion." So you have to be smart. You have to be analytic. You have to know the sources. And you also have to apply justice and compassion as you try to apply those sources. And, of course, it's not easy. That's why you turn to people like Rabbi Usher Weiss to deal with these things. But it's important to recognize that it's a struggle and that the cases are never going to quite match up perfectly. And that's the job of those who want to address these cases, to figure out, so how do you apply precedents that we have, laws that are on the books, to the case at hand? So I include that as just an opening cautionary note. Let's talk secular perspective on our opening two questions. We already answered them somewhat, although as you'll see, we did not answer them fully. There's more to be said. But I assume that at least some of the people here are familiar with something called force majeure. Right? I know I'm pronouncing it properly because I specifically went online and found a place where they gave you, here's how you pronounce these words. Force majeure. I spent a lot of time working on that because I did not learn French in school growing up. Thank you. What is that?
When there are clauses in contracts that list certain situations in which the contract can be canceled.
Exactly. It's a clause in a contract. This is really important. To the accountants, I think this is obvious. The lawyers as well. But it's a clause in a contract which is meant to govern what we do in a situation where everything has gone haywire, essentially. That's a technical term. If you take a look at source number two on your sheet, I found a very helpful paper out of Dickinson Wright. There's a lot of stuff online, but I happen to like the way they framed it, so this is what I'm using. Force majeure clauses authorize contracting parties to extend or suspend the time of performance, or to be excused from performance in whole or in part, as a result of specifically negotiated and enumerated conditions or events. Okay? In the event that such and such happens, I do not have to do whatever I committed to, or I can do it in a different way. You don't have to do what you committed to. You can do it in a different way. That's the guts of a force majeure clause. Obligations under the contract may resume once the condition or event has been remedied, right? Sometimes it's a temporary thing. It's very funny when you read the literature on cases that came up in March and April, and you see people saying, well, this is only a temporary thing, so therefore maybe your clause doesn't apply. And it's like, hi guys, it's October. We're still here. but that's what people were thinking. So he says, your obligations might resume once whatever the event is has been remedied. A determination of the exact circumstances will depend on the clause and its place contextually within the contract as a whole. Not going into that right now. If a party wants to rely on a force majeure clause, they must first establish that the event or condition falls within the definition of force majeure. This is evaluated in the context of each specific contract. In other words, contracts may be very specific as to what meets the standard of force majeure. Older contracts tend to be more vague. Modern ones may say something like public health crisis, but older ones don't necessarily. And in the event that you don't have a clear definition of what constitutes force majeure, you may indeed have a problem, and you may need the courts address whether this case actually fits the clause in the agreement. It's not enough for me to say, well, now you can't fulfill it. You need to actually, now you can't fulfill the contract. It depends on whether it's all within the clause as written in the agreement. Also worth noting is what they mention next here. The Supreme Court of Canada, in the leading decision, Atlantic Paper Stock versus somebody, defined the force majeure clause as, quote, generally operating to discharge a contracting party when a supervening, sometimes supernatural event beyond control of either party makes performance impossible. The common thread is that of the unexpected, something beyond reasonable human foresight and skill. So it's not just something that came along that completely demolished the contract, but it also is something you couldn't have expected at the time when you entered the contract. If I contract with somebody for a service, and the service is disrupted, but everybody knew that disruption was going to take place, you can't activate a clause for that. And finally, it is not sufficient that the event makes performance more expensive or time-consuming than expected. The event must make performance substantially more difficult, substantially more expensive, or imprudent. That's the idea here. All right, is this clear? So, the clause in the contract may take care of a lot of cases, but what if I don't have a force majeure clause in my contract. Now what do I do? So somebody mentioned before, when I dealt with the case of the fire that demolished the camp, that the contract can't be fulfilled. They can't provide the service. So this is what we call frustration of contract. Nothing written into a contract addresses frustration of contract. It just is a thing. It's a circumstance that happens. And Ontario has a Frustrated Contracts Act. Who knew? I didn't know that a couple of weeks ago. Now I know. We have an act. And the act deals with that case where you don't have a clause in your agreement, but the contract has become impossible to fulfill. Take a look at source number 3. This is section 2 of the Frustrated Contracts Act. This act applies to any contract that is governed by the law of Ontario and that has become impossible of performance or been otherwise frustrated, and to the parties which for that reason have been discharged. So we're talking about where you can't fulfill the contract. But really important, the contract has to be truly frustrated. This is a great case. Take a look at source number 4. The case of Bal versus Infinite Entertainment Sound and Lighting. And the story was that there was a wedding that was supposed to take place. And then the province said, you can't have more than X number of people. I think it's 50 people in this particular case. And on that basis, the bride and groom say, we want to cancel the contract because we hired them thinking we were going to have a wedding for 1,000 people. We don't need all of this entertainment stuff for a wedding of 50 people. We don't want to shell out for the expense for a wedding of 50 people. So therefore, they want to cancel the agreement. Look what the court says. The court says, you're out of luck, and it explains. I say this because, although the government restrictions on gatherings of more than 50 people limited the wife's intended reception attendance, this does not render the party's contract impossible. Rather, the company was willing and able to perform the contract, either with a smaller group in attendance on the original March 29, 2020 date, or some future date within 18 months. So they were willing to perform. For a contract to be frustrated, it must be truly impossible to continue to perform the terms of the contract. Not just inconvenient, undesirable, or uncomfortable, you're out of luck. I thought that was really remarkable that the court would say that. I mean, I would view a wedding of 1,000 people as fundamentally different from a wedding of 50 people. But that's the argument that is brought in this case. So applying these two points, force majeure and frustration of contract, hang on 1 minute. I'm just going to do a quick summary of these two points, and then I'll take questions. When you're dealing with the case of the fire, our first case, the camp can't provide the service. That's very clear. When you're dealing with COVID, if the government is saying no summer camp at all, then again, you're out of luck. I'm not dealing, by the way, with practical reality. I don't remember at this point whether they actually banned all summer camps in Ontario or not. I think there was a lot going on there at that point. But the point is, if they actually ban it, then you're out. On the other hand, if they didn't ban it, if they didn't actually ban the summer camp, but they said you could have a summer camp, you just have smaller bunks, that may indeed change the story in terms of how we look at it. However, one last point I forgot to mention, and then Moshe, I'll take your comment. Take a look at source number 5. I neglected to mention this. I brought you another piece from the Frustrated Contracts Act. And Moshe, I'm just going to mute you until I'm ready for you because there's background noise there. They note that you may not be able to demand a full refund. The sums paid or payable to a party in pursuance of a contract before the parties were discharged, in the case of sums paid, are recoverable from the party, right? You can get it back, whatever you paid already, and sums payable cease to be payable, but if before the parties were discharged, the party to whom the sums were paid or payable incurred expenses, they built a bunk in connection with the performance of the contract, The court, if it considers it just to do so, having regard to all the circumstances, may allow the party to retain or to recover, as the case may be, the whole or any part. There's a lot of legalese here. I'm going to sum it up in my own words. They may indeed say they're able to claim, part of what was already given to them, or part of what was due to them, in exchange for the work that they already did, the investment they already made. And then, further, in the event that the client actually received some benefit, they may be required to make some payment for the benefit that they received. The summer camp case, there's no benefit, right? They didn't actually gain anything. But in other cases, we can clearly envision that where they have benefited and then COVID disrupted everything, they'll have to pay for the benefit that they already received. Moshe, you waited very patiently. Thank you. What do you have? Uh-oh. I'm assuming it was Moshe because he asked me for a phone number.
Sorry about that.
There you go. Yeah.
So does that get broken down? Like, for instance, like if you take a hall, there's the rental of a hall issue that, okay, they didn't get to whether they choose to have a wedding of 250 and now they're down to 25 people. But does that get split between catering also? Because people, you're supposed to have your wedding of 1,000 people. You're supposed to give X number of dollars per head. And then COVID, they say, oh, no, you can only have 25 people. Does that get split up proportionally?
That's a really good question. Part of this, if I understand your question correctly, actually goes back to a bigger question which comes up in the Jewish law articles on this all the time, which is the question of, is it a relationship between the person who is making the wedding, the contracting party on that side, and each individual organization, entity on the other side? Or do we say, if I hire a caterer, the caterer is the one making arrangements with all their staff. The caterer is the one buying the food. It's all one lump arrangement, and I just have to settle with the caterer, and that's all it is. It's viewed as me hiring the caterer for the caterer's services and goods and all that. It's one person, or is it separate entities? So the simple answer to this is each one, it seems, has their own claim. The only question is whether it's going directly back to the client or to the person who hired them if there was a middleman. You follow? Moshe? Lost you. What I'm suggesting, in other words, is this. From a Jewish law perspective, we distinguish between the frustration of an agreement in which you hire a worker and frustration of an attempt to purchase goods. So in the event that I hire a caterer for a wedding, and the caterer is employing people, and the caterer is buying goods, I may say, my agreement is just with the caterer. I'm hiring the caterer for a service. And the caterer has to settle up with the people they were getting the goods from. And the caterer has to settle up with the employees they hired for the job, but it's not my headache. It's one service that I retained. Not me versus the food wholesaler. Me versus the people who were supposed to work that day, or their bookkeeper, or whoever else. Okay. So we've more or less given some guidance in terms of the secular approach to this.
Kevin, may I ask one quick question about insurance, because it's come up a number of times.
Yeah.
We talked about if the vendor uses the money to build something, if they're made whole by insurance, does that impact the relationship between the camper parents, et cetera?
Right. So them being made whole doesn't directly affect it. I'm going to speak from a Jewish law perspective, because it doesn't affect it, largely because in a case of frustration of contract, I don't have to pay them anyway.
Rabbi, you said that if they use that money to build extra cabins, then you might have to pay for that, because that money of deposit was used in the cemetery.
Right. Oh, so in terms of refunding that may be true, right? In terms of refunding expenditures that they've already made, I can't speak to it from a secular perspective. So I wouldn't, you know, that I wouldn't necessarily be able to answer you. From a Jewish law perspective, in the event that their expenditures that they've already made are covered, are not a loss, then yes, you can make that argument that I don't need to worry about that. And there's more to be said, because I think it's a little more complicated than that, but I think that's a fair statement. And just, I'm watching the clock, and I see Mark has his hand up, and it's 12:57, and I haven't yet gotten to the Jewish law side of things. So, Mark, what were you going to say? Or is your hand up by accident?
In March, Air Canada canceled my trip to Israel, and they said they're not going to give refunds. You could use a voucher for 2 years. I want my money, but they said, you know what? Our plates are functioning. It wasn't our idea. We were told to cancel.
Right. So these are things that we're going to talk about now. That's exactly where we're going, is the quest. Well, really, you raised two questions in one. Right? The question of partial performance, we're offering to do something, it's just not necessarily what you like, as well as, along the way, you hinted at the credit question. We're not interested in refunding your money, but we'll give you credit. So those raise all sorts of complications. Let's see how far we can get in the next half hour. Miriam, is this, yeah, all right.
Very quick. Yeah.
Right, so there are cases in which insurance does come into play, but it's a bigger topic. It's not one I'm going to get into right now. But you did give me an idea for the May series. So thank you very much. I'm always looking for good topics, and I think that's a winner. Okay. So let's talk Jewish law, because we haven't even really started on it. I'm just going to note, because a few people signed in, or came in, I should say, late, make sure you sign in the chat, or, you know, well, first of all, sign in so that you can get the emails with all the information about this class and future classes, but also so that you can get your credit letter. Okay, whose fault is the external circumstance is a question that Judaism asks. In other words, Judaism asks the same questions that secular society asks regarding force majeure and regarding frustration of contract, but then we have a new question, which is, whose fault is it? Meaning, force majeure is recognized. As a general rule, all conditions agreed upon by two sides in financial matters are binding. So, for example, the Torah says day laborers are entitled to be paid by sunrise the next day, but if they say, we're okay being paid at the end of the week, that's fine. They can forgive the right the Torah gives them. As long as forgiving that right doesn't cause a direct violation of Jewish law. So, example, Jewish law says that the sabbatical year cancels loans that are already in default. Right? If I owe somebody money, the money is already due, and I haven't paid them by the sabbatical year, by the end of the sabbatical year, according to most authorities, then my loan is canceled. What if I take out a loan, and I agree to a contract which says the sabbatical year will not cancel the loan? That does not work. You cannot neglect that, and you can't negate that fact. But a force majeure statement of, in the event of a fire, in the event of a public health disaster, whatever it is, here's what we're going to do as a result, that indeed is binding. And not only that, if you take a look at source number 6, Rabbi Asher Weiss pointed out in source number 6 that we take it as a given in Jewish law, which is kind of the opposite of what force majeure is. It's not supposed to be a given. But take a look at what he says. He's dealing with a rental agreement. Even though it was explicitly declared in the rental agreement that under no circumstances could the tenant back out of the rental, and even in a situation of ones, even if there are circumstances beyond their control that were not anticipated and so on, a makat medina is different. Makat medina, I'm going to translate for now as a nationwide disaster. Something that is, that's a calamity that affects everybody. We have to refine our definition in a little bit. In all such cases, he could not have anticipated it. further the law, and straight intellect require us to recognize that a renter's onus, a circumstance that happens that's beyond anybody's control, like illness or death, God forbid, or other events and harms that occur, are different from a makat medina, which has no tie to the renter. I'm getting a little bit of field in this, and I didn't want to. I probably should have just ellipsized part of this, because really the next part is what we really want. What he's trying to say first is that there is such a thing as ones, circumstances beyond your control, that destroy the contract, that completely frustrate it. There is even such a thing as makat medina, which we have to talk about, where everybody's contracts are frustrated. And he says it's a given that those are significant in Jewish law. And then he says, this is the part that I really wanted, and many contracts include an explicit clause stating that in a case of force majeure, he calls it makat medina, the renter may back out, the tenant may back out, and even if it is not written explicitly, such is the straight law. It's a given you can back out. You don't even need a clause. Now, this doesn't really substitute for force majeure, because force majeure is more than just a clause saying you can back out in the event that there's a disaster. They also tell us how to manage the investment and what each party will do. That's not, you can't just assume that. That requires that you have an actual clause. Nonetheless, we absolutely recognize a force majeure clause, and then we also recognize frustration of contract. What Rabbi Weiss referred to as ones, a circumstance which is a calamity that prevents delivery of services, is something that has ample precedent in Jewish law. Take a look at source number 7, please, where I give you an example. Wagon drivers were hired to transport grain. They arrive at the field and there's no grain. The grain is destroyed, the grain never developed, whatever it was. You hired people to work in your field. There is a pouring rain. The field is soaked. You can't do any work in the field. What's the rule? So the beginning of source number 7 says you have to pay them fully. You have to pay them, even though they didn't do the work, because of this circumstance that we call ones. You have to pay them. However, you don't pay them in full. Why? Because they didn't work. So what you do is you pay them not to work. There's an old Marx Brothers routine like that in Animal Crackers about paying people not to sing. Here, you pay them not to work in your field. So you're not paying them full wages, you're paying them partial wages. That's what you're doing. How you evaluate that is a fantastic question for another time. There's a practical view that says go with 50% of wages. It really should depend on the field of work and the individual. We're not going into the complications now of how you calculate it because it's tangential. But the statement here, at least at the beginning, is you have to pay the workers in the event of ones, to which the Talmud says, really? This was taught before Rav. Rav, a leading sage in the beginning of the third century, in the middle of the third century, they said to him, pay them fully. And he replied, you know, I have a beloved uncle. His uncle was Rabbi Chia. He was called my beloved uncle. Anybody know why? Chavivi was the term used in the Hebrew. What's the normal term that's used for an uncle in Hebrew?
Dod.
Dod, which means not just uncle, but
beloved.
He used the term Chavivi, which means really beloved, because Rav Chia was his uncle on both sides. Because of a half-sibling situation in the older generation, he was actually his father's brother and his mother's brother. So he was uncle on both sides. He says, my beloved uncle said, if I had been there when they said pay fully, I would have given them nothing. They didn't do the work. You're telling me you should pay them or pay them as an idle worker? He says, what are you talking about? Then how do we explain this? How are we supposed to explain why they said to pay like an idle worker? Well, it depends who knew that they weren't going to be able to do the work. And basically what we say to digest what you see here, if the employer knew that this was a risk, the employer had a duty to say so in the agreement. And if he didn't do so, then he has to pay them. However, in the event that nobody knew or they had equal access to the information, then you don't pay. You follow Rav's statement, you aren't going to pay them. It's ones. He's not, you know, it's frustration of contract. That's all there is to say. Another example of this is a discussion that the sages have about a tenant who dies midway through the lease. And again, where it was not something that could have been anticipated. And the rule, I didn't bring it on the sheet, but it's in Shulchan Aruch HaShem Mishpat Shin Lamed Daled in the beginning. The rule is there is no payment. There's some discussion about what happens if the tenant prepaid. There's some debate. There are a couple of reasons to keep the money, that the landlord could be able to keep the money. Making a long story short, one argument for the landlord being able to keep the money is because we could view the rental agreement as having actually happened in the beginning of the year. It's like a sale. You sell someone something, and later they're not able to use it because they passed away. That's not my problem. I sold them something. That's one argument for saying the landlord can keep the rent. Another argument for the landlord keeping the rent is to say, when you prepay, you accept certain risks. That's the way it goes. But I'm leaving that discussion for another time. It's a fun discussion, but I want to make sure that we get through our main topic. The general point is, ones is the Hebrew term that is equivalent to frustration of contract in law. If something happens, as far as Jewish law is concerned, we recognize that the force majeure clause is binding, and in the absence of such a clause, we'll say if there's frustration of contract, then you're not responsible to pay unless you knew in advance that was a reality you were going to have to contend with. However, going back to the question that Mark asked about Air Canada, we do ask, what if the service could still be delivered? Take a look at source number 8, please. Passage from the Talmud. Somebody hired a person to transport his wine. I grew wine in Israel. I want to sell it in, I don't know, the United Arab Emirates, and I want to take it on a boat to the UAE. So I hire the boat, put my wine on the boat, and the boat sinks partway through the journey. Iran was not involved. The boat sank under natural circumstances. So Rabbi Natan said, if I've already paid him for the boat ride, I can't take it back. Too late, you prepaid. If I have not paid, though, then I don't need to pay. So the Talmud asks, what are you talking about? Either I should get a refund, right? Or I'm entitled to nothing and I should pay him. What's the case? So the Talmud explains, if you flip to the next sheet, if the arrangement was that I hired this boat specifically, I told him I want this boat, and I'm going to transport wine. I didn't specify which wine. So now the boat went down with my wine on it. Even if I paid, I should receive a refund. I should be able to say, bring me your boat back, and I'm going to bring wine. The fact that he can't provide the boat I hired, I said I want this boat. Go to Mark's case. I said I want to go to Israel on this date. If you can't provide that service, I am due a refund. On the other hand, if the arrangement was the opposite, I said, give me a boat. I don't care which boat. I just want my wine to get there. But I want it to be this wine, and now boat sinks with my wine on it, then I should have to pay him. Because the boat owner says, I have more boats. I am ready to fulfill the agreement. It's your problem that you have to bring me wine. That's not my problem. I am ready. The contract is not frustrated. You follow? I'm saying it a little quickly, so let me unpack it and say it a little more slowly. We ask whether the service could still be delivered. If one of the sides is still able to fulfill their part of the bargain, if Air Canada says, I am able to bring you on a different day, and we view your airline ticket as open, you could have gone on any day, so we're willing to bring you, it's your problem that you don't want to go when we can take you, then you still have to pay. If you say, I am willing to go, you haven't furnished the plane, government won't let you, whatever it is, then there's no reason I should have to pay. We look at whether the contract could still be fulfilled, just like in the wedding case. But you have to be careful about how you interpret that the contract could be fulfilled. That's part of the challenge, just like in the wedding case. Is it really fulfilling the contract if you're performing for 50 people instead of 1,000 people? Does that really constitute fulfilling it? In the airline case, you're willing to take me 3 months later. Is that really the same thing when I missed my nephew's bar mitzvah? Right? So that requires evaluation by a rabbinical court. So far, so good. Civil law, really common law, when you're talking about frustration of contract, is the same as Jewish law. However, there's a uniquely Jewish question that we then throw in. I mentioned it before, and now I want to explain it. And that is, who owns the ones? With whom exactly does the blame lie? Whose fault is the external circumstance? There's an idea of fault involved. By default, the fault is associated with the party who was expected to earn benefit. There was a party who expected to act in order to receive payment. So the fault, so to speak, is with them. Let me show you what I mean. Go back to the case that we talked about with the field. You hired field workers. It was in source number 7, above Metzia 76B. You hired field workers, and they showed up, and the field was soaking wet. So we said, they don't get anything. Unless the boss knew beforehand, and they didn't know, they're not getting paid. Why don't they get paid? So take a look at source number 9. Rashi says, when he says, I would have given them nothing, because their mazel caused it. It's their fault. Their mazel caused it. Now, I want to explain what mazel means and what it doesn't mean. We're not quite there yet. Not everybody agrees with Rashi that we're assigning blame, so to speak, and saying it's the worker's mazel. There is a view presented in the authority known as Rabbeinu Usher, the Rush, in which he says that's not really what's at stake. It's really, I don't know whose mazel it is. You could say it's the owner of the field's mazel. You could say it's the worker's mazel. I don't know. Therefore, whoever is holding the money gets to keep it. Hamotzi mechavero alav haraya. You can't prove whose fault this is, so forget fault altogether, and everybody stays with what they have. But Rashi's view is indeed that it's about mazel. He applies it also in another case, in source number 10, where the Talmud talks about a case in which you get a field from somebody else, you rent a field, I should say, from somebody else, and then the field is demolished, locusts, plague, whatever it was, destroyed the field. Do you still have to pay your rent? And the answer is, you do have to pay your rent. You can see it in source number 10, unless it's what's called a makat medina, which we're going to get to. Why do I still have to pay the rent? Why can't I say frustration of contract? Rashi in source number 11, because the owner of the field, the landlord, says it was your mazel that caused it. That's why. So therefore, you're out of luck. So what does mazel mean? When we say this, in general, tell me what the word mazel means. Somebody.
Luck.
Mazel luck. So the truth of the matter is that in its original use, mazel means the arrangement of the stars, right? We call the constellations and the areas of the zodiac, we call them mazalot. It means the arrangement of the stars. So what exactly does astrology have to do with financial law? Two ways to take it. I'm going to give you the mainstream view, and then I'm going to show you one other view. The mainstream view is that this is a practical statement, not a philosophical statement. It means this happened, stuff goes on, the universe is arranged in such a way that you got harmed, it's your loss, don't expect me to pay for it. So in other words, I own the field. Hang on, Miriam. I own the field. You said you were going to pay me rent for the field. Pay me rent for the field. Ah, but the field is useless to you? That's your problem. That's not my problem. You can't shift the harm that hurt you onto my shoulders. And what I mean by that, take a look at source number 12, a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. You have a field. There's an irrigation ditch. The irrigation ditch, if you watch back to its source, is starting to flood. If that flood hits your field, it's going to damage your field. Are you allowed to divert the water from that irrigation ditch? knowing that then it's going to hit somebody else's ditch, right? It's like the trolley car problem, except now you're personally involved. Are you allowed to divert the water so that it hits somebody else's field instead of your own? Says the Jerusalem Talmud, until the water enters your field, yes, you are allowed to do that. You're protecting your field. Once it comes into your field, you're not able to bail out your field by dumping the water into somebody else's. That's not cool. You're allowed to prevent it from getting to you. You're not allowed to empty out your field into theirs. Same idea here. The idea here is, I'm sorry, pal, I feel really bad that the field is flooded and you can't use it. But the water, so to speak, already hit you. You can't now say, I'm going to make Torchina eat it. That's like taking the water out of your field and dumping it on me. This happened to you. It's mazel. It's just the way the universe works. Things happen. I'm sorry for you, but I'm not eating the loss. It's your loss. That's the normal way to take this. However, there is a Rabbi Yosef Fleischman, who's the head of a rabbinical court in Jerusalem, who goes further in source number 13, and he says, no, nothing in Judaism is fate. It's God. He says, we view mazel as a divine decree. If this person suffered, it's because God said so. That's just the way it is. And therefore, they have to absorb the loss. He sees it as a religious statement, not a practical statement. So what I'm trying to say here, and what I hope we're getting out of what we've said so far, is that Judaism asks a question in a case of frustration of contract. Who is the one who got hit? Who got flooded? The party who was supposed to act in order to earn benefit is the one who is out of luck. So if you were supposed to pay me rent to use my field to get benefit from it, you still have to pay me. That's the idea. Barring a circumstance we have to see, but now I'll take Miriam's question.
Would they have to pay him back? Or is it really a case of Hamotzi Michavero, and now the money is in their hand and it's in the bad luck of the Balabai?
Good. Excellent question. So that's a difference between Rashi and the Rush. The Rush will say, keep it, as you said, Hamotzi Michavero El Avaraya, you've got the money, you get to keep it. Rashi will say no. It gets reversed. So yes, that's a difference between Rashi and the Rush. Yes, correct. You got it. So in our case of the summer camp and the fire, and I'm assuming it's a local fire for reasons that we'll see shortly. Secular law, if there's a force majeure case clause, that dominates. And if not, then ask, can the contract be fulfilled? Should the harm have been anticipated? If it can't be fulfilled and the harm shouldn't have been anticipated, no further questions. The contract is void. It's done. You don't have to pay them. And in fact, you get your money refunded other than the expenditures they made as the court evaluates. Within Jewish law, the parent can back out and say, I'm not interested in paying you and I want a refund if they have a force majeure clause or if we take it as automatic. And we also recognize frustration of contract. It's the camp's mazel that this happened. So therefore, the parent can back out. So far, it's relatively straightforward. But now let's apply it to COVID, and I'm mindful of the fact that we have 10 minutes left, so I saw a couple of questions that people sent me in the chat, but I'm gonna have to first get through the next 10 minutes. Someone asked a question to me, their mic isn't working, so they wrote, if you paid for a Pesach program, and because of COVID, they don't return your money. So we're getting to COVID now, where the fire piece doesn't cover the COVID discussion for reasons we're now gonna get to. So COVID is different, and it goes back to that phrase that I used very quickly before called Makat Medina. Makat Medina means, as I said before, literally a nationwide catastrophe. Now there's no one to blame. It's not that it's my problem or his problem. It's everybody's problem. It's everybody's mazel at this point. It hit everybody. If you take a look at source number 10, The case that we mentioned already before. You rented a field from somebody, and it's eaten by locusts, and it's damaged by plague. So we say, if it's makat medina, if everybody got hit by this, then you're allowed to reduce your rental payment and say, I'm not paying for that. Because now it's not about your mazel anymore. Now it's everybody's mazel. Now, that's true in a rental case. Will it apply in the case of a worker? The answer seems to be yes. If you take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Moshe Isserles dealt with a case in which you had someone who was hired to teach a kid. And then the government issued a decree. None of this Torah study. We're not interested in Torah study. We are banning Torah study. This is a practical case. It's dealt with in the literature going back to the 13th century. So the question is, do the parents have to pay the tutor? So the Maharam of Rothenburg said, in this case, it's a makat medina. This isn't about this individual teacher. This is in the whole land. No one's allowed to learn Torah. So therefore, you don't say it's the mazel of the teacher. Rather, the teacher has to get paid. That's the way it works. That's the position of Rabbi Moshe Isserles. There's a commentary on the Code of Jewish Law called the Sefer Me'irat Einayim, also known as the Sma. And he says, no way! The teacher didn't do the job. He didn't do the teaching. So there's a lot of commentary on this case, and it's a great discussion for another time to really expand on this. But I knew I wasn't going to have the time to do that, and instead I brought you Rav Asher Weiss's explanation of why you still have to pay. Two reasons. Hang on, John. He gives you... All right, so go ahead, John, and then I'll give the two reasons. Quickly.
Very, very quickly. Why is it called Makat Medina? Because surely the tutor could go and work on something else, could do something else.
Right. It's not, but you hired him to do this. You're right, but we hired him to do this, and he had an agreement, and he didn't pursue other work. So the first answer that Rabbi Weiss gives, and I brought it for you in source number 15, but I'm going to say it outside of the text, is that when it comes to determining whose mazal it is, you go back to the root, so to speak. And in this case, the root is the child and the child's father. Parents, to be fair. They're the ones who wanted the teaching. They're the ones who stand to benefit from the teaching. They're the ones who hired the teacher. So they lose. But then he gives you a second approach, which is really intriguing with far-reaching ramifications. He says, you know, Jewish law is really interesting in terms of employer-employee relations. Jewish law always favors the employee. That's the way it works. And he says, you see it in a variety of laws and mitzvot. The rule of same-day payment is one example, but there's much, much more, in which the bias is on behalf of the employee. He says, it wouldn't just be for a teacher. He says, in general, the rule is you have to pay him in the event that it's makat medina, because it hit everybody. That's his statement. Now, what does everybody really mean? What do you mean when you say everybody? So, if you go back to the language in source number 10, we read the first part, the Mishnah, which said that you rented a field and then the field was destroyed. If it's Makat Medina, you can choose to reduce your rental payment. The Gemara, the expansion on this Mishnah says, what is a Makat Medina exactly? Rabbi Yehuda said, for example, if most of the fields were damaged by blight. Ula said, if the surrounding fields on all sides were damaged by blight. But focus on Rav Yehuda. He said if most of the fields were damaged by blight, that's already enough. It doesn't have to be all fields. Even most is sufficient, and that's brought by the Shach, a commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. But then you have to ask, how do you determine most exactly? Rav Asher Weiss is dealing with a common question over the past year. You had young families who were from various places around the world, who rented apartments in Israel for a year. They're going to live in Israel for a year. Midway through the year, they hit COVID. They leave. They figure, I'm going to go home, I'll be with my parents for Pesach, and then I'll come back. And then, of course, the government will not allow them to come back. So, how do you view this? Is it Makat Medina or not? On the one hand, I would love to do this as a discussion, but it's 126. On the one hand, you could make the argument that most tenants in Israel are still in Israel. So therefore, it's not most. It's not Makat Medina. On the other hand, most of this population, the young families from outside of Israel, left and went home. So for them, it is a makat medina. It's all in how you define your population. So the answer seems to be that just like in the case of a field, we look at that group of fields. We don't say all the fields in the land. It's that group of fields. So too here, we can define it based on the market. And it's that specific market. And therefore, it would be called makat medina. So now let's go back to our summer camp case and try to apply makat medina. If government legislation says no overnight camps in Ontario, that qualifies as makat medina. Even if some minimal number of camps gain an exception, it's still most. Therefore, the camp cannot be said to own the catastrophe. The onus is not there. And therefore, Rabbi Isserles will say to pay them. Now, the Sma will say, don't pay them. They didn't do the work. So Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, said something that's widely quoted in this. He said, since it's a debate, do a pshara, do a compromise, come out with some way to make this thing work. Don't say it's all or nothing. How that's implemented is challenging, but that brings me to my last point, which is the last sheet, which was question number 3, which is the greater ethical duty. And there isn't time to go into all of the parameters and ramifications of this, but I just wanted to show you 2 sources. Number 1, there is a biblical obligation traceable to a verse in Exodus in the beginning of Parshat Yitro of going lifnim mishurat hadin. Yitro says to Moshe, you shall teach the Jews the path they shall walk and the deeds they shall perform. And the Talmud deduces from that that there are more obligations, not just the law, but the path you shall walk and the deeds you shall do. And that includes to go beyond the letter of the law. That's number 1. And then number 2, there's this great story in source number 17. Rabbi Bar Bar Chanan hired porters to carry his wine barrels. A lot of wine going on. He took their cloaks. I'm sorry, they smashed the wine barrels. That happened first. He takes their cloaks as payment for the barrels. They complained to the sage Rav. Rav said, give them back their cloaks. He says, is that the law? Are you serious? He says, yes. So that you will walk the path of the good. Verse in Proverbs, in Mishle. The porters then said, you know, we're really hungry. We worked all day long. We have nothing. He said, pay them. He says, really? Is that the law? And he gives you the rest of that verse in Proverbs. You shall guard the path of the righteous. Now, there's a lot going on here. This I gave a 4-part series of classes to an advanced group last year on this passage. There's so much going on. I'm just trying to show that it is a consideration in Jewish law when they come back to you and say, but we're going to go broke if everybody gets a refund. Again, insurance is a separate discussion, but if they say, we're going to go broke, if everybody's going to demand their money back, the Pesach programs and so on, you do have to ask, at what point do I need to be gentle? And do I need to say, this is tzedaka? It's my tzedaka. It counts towards my meiser. I need to be able to help them out. Now, I have bills of my own to pay. This money that was going to go towards the Pesach program is money I could use for tuition. Then why were you going on the Pesach program? All right, that's its own discussion. But the point is that it's legitimate for people to say, have rachmanus, have some mercy. So speaking of mercy, it's now 1:30. I'm going to stay on and continue the conversation, but I don't want to hold people past the time that they committed to. So just make sure, please, that you signed in so that I have your information. And then if you want to go, you can go. But I'm going to stick around to continue the conversation. I see a question in the chat. So does a Jewish employer who is very wealthy have the right to fire an employee due to COVID? So that's missing a lot of circumstances for this case. So first, I'm just going to post the link for the source sheet again in case anybody doesn't have it. That's a really legitimate question. If what you're asking is, I hired somebody. I hired somebody to clean my house on a weekly basis. They can't come clean my house on a weekly basis during COVID. That's not an option. I don't want them in my house and they don't want to be in my house. Or maybe there's a lockdown and they're not considered an essential worker and therefore they have to stay home. However you want to apply it. So in a case like that, do I have the right to say you didn't come clean the house? Well, their answer is going to be it's makat medina. This affected everybody. It's not just me. No one is able to go clean houses. So it's not just about me. I don't own this. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, is going to reply that in such a case you have to pay. Someone just sent me a message saying just to supply you with my contact info, but they didn't actually put their info in the chat. So I hope that they'll continue to do that. You know who you are. I hope you didn't sign off already. So the answer would be the Rama, Rabbi Isserles, would say that you have to pay. The Sma would say, no, you don't. And the Chasim Sofer, Moshe Sofer, would say, compromise, pay something. That's what would end up happening. Now, somebody wrote to me following up on the Pesach program question. They were in a Pesach program, which canceled because they didn't have enough guests, and they refused to return the money. Should I have had mercy on them? So that's not Makat Medina, right? That's not a case of everybody getting hit. That's a case of this person getting hit. And I think then you go back and say, Mazlo Garam, his Mazel caused it, and therefore it's on him, and doesn't have the ability to demand payment. Should you have mercy on them? Mercy is a wonderful thing. If you can afford to help them out a little bit, help them to at least recover their costs, I think that's a nice thing to do, and there's a lot of merit to doing it. But one of the things that I didn't have time to spell out in the general session, but I'll mention now, is if you look at those last two cases, right, the last two sources, I should say, the first one about transcending the line of the law, and the one about the porters and the wine barrels. The Talmud in the last case, in the wine barrel case, does not apply lifnim mishurat hadin. It doesn't say this is about going beyond the line of the law. The Talmud doesn't use that phrase. Rashi, commenting on it, does. He believes this is part of the biblical obligation. Tosfot disagrees and says, no, this is just pure kindness. This is not an obligation. This is just being a nice guy. Tosfot believes that the biblical obligation of going beyond the letter of the law is only where the other party really has a substantive right to your assistance. If they don't have a right to your assistance beyond just be a nice guy, give someone tzedakah, then it's not really a biblical obligation of going beyond the letter of the law. It's just an obligation of, hey, be a nice guy, help people out. You give people tzedakah, so give this person tzedakah. That's the difference between the cases. I'm going to address a question that just came in. If you have to pay the teacher for a period of time, even though they're not able to teach, are you able to fulfill the teaching once the situation changes? So that's a really interesting question. If there's a possibility that they could still teach in time, in other words, it's not time-bound teaching. Let's say the kid is still going to be able to learn next year, and will need to learn at that point, you could argue there was no frustration of contract at all. There was no onus, it's just delayed. And therefore, you'll pay him what you were going to pay him for his work, and he'll teach you, he'll do the delivery of services next year. You don't have to pay him for this year and next year. I think that's correct. John, you were going to say?
Very quickly, vis-a-vis government grants, if the person who's supposed to be performing the contract gets government grants, say, for example, what such we're going on with us here in Canada, what is the status of those funds? Are those funds should be, first of all, I guess, for the queue of the business, but is there an obligation of the person who received the grants to also to use them for the refunds as opposed to?
Yes. Correct. So the answer is yes. Meaning in the responsa on these questions that have come up during COVID, that's been one of the questions. What if the government is helping out? And it's not, it goes also back to our insurance point. And the answer is yes. That absolutely is part of the calculus. Before you start figuring out what the customer has to pay in or forgive, take into consideration the fact that they've gotten benefits via the government, and that reduces the loss that they were suffering. There are all sorts of very interesting nuances and complications to this. I'll give you an example. I've mentioned a couple of debates regarding how to view things. So we have a principle in Jewish law called Kimli. We've mentioned it on occasion. Kimli says that if I am in a dispute with somebody else, and in fact there's a rabbinic debate as to how to resolve it, I am entitled to go to the Beit Din, to go to the court, and to say, I adopt that view, because that view is favorable to me. I want the view that will favor my side, and that's actually legitimate for me to do. So what about the following case in which you have, Rav Asher Weiss deals with this question. What if you have a woman who, in this particular case, it's a woman, could just as well be a man, who works in child care, but also sends her child to child care. And now, the people who watch her kids are not able to work, and she is not able to work. So on the one hand, she goes to the person who hired her and says, I follow the view that says you have to pay me. But then she goes to the people she's supposed to be paying to watch her kid and says, I follow the view that says that I don't have to pay you. Can you really do a paradoxical Kimli in which you win on both ends? And the short answer, no surprise, is no. That's not acceptable. Do not try that. Okay.
Can I ask one quick question about the airline? It kind of segues a little bit from what you just said. So if the airline says, here's a voucher, you can use it any time in the next 2 years, when you bought the original ticket, it was non-cancelable and you had to fly that date, and if you didn't fly on that date, you'd be out of luck. So how can they turn to you and say, I'm giving you another date to fly, when if you would have chosen to fly a different date, under normal circumstances, you wouldn't have been allowed?
Right, so some part of this, when you're dealing with airlines, has to do also with the regulations in air travel. Meaning, you're not just negotiating your own contract with them when you buy a ticket, but there are all sorts of rules that go with it that governments establish. And if government says, as government has done, regarding airlines, that they have a degree of flexibility in that regard, then you have a problem, as a customer. But it's a given walking in. Last question I'll take I see two hands. All right. I'll take a question from Mark. I'll take a question from Miriam, but that's it because I have another class that I have to go teach. So, yes, Mark.
You focus a lot on the term muzzle, and it says, I think in Rashi, Ein muzzle Israel. Is that referring to something else, or is that relevant to this?
Right, so it's actually Gemara in Shabbos that says, Ein mazal Yisrael, which I like to think of as meaning, Jews just have no luck. But no, that's not what it means. Ein mazal Yisrael in context means that the zodiac and the constellations don't control our fate, that through our deeds, hopefully good ones, we can transcend mazal. It actually, originates in the parsha a couple of weeks ago, and God taking Abraham out of the stars or out of his tent and leave your astrology. But it also, the Gemara has it in a story with Rabbi Akiva and his daughter. But it means you can transcend it, but it doesn't change the fact that the statement here is either a statement not so much. Hang on, it's either a statement not really about your luck, as much as it is a practical statement of, look, this happened on your watch. That's one way to review it. Or the view of, this is actually God's decree, Rabbi Fleischman's read, which I think defies the use of the phrase mazel. You shouldn't have used the term mazel if that wasn't what you meant. But that's his read of it. But either way, they're not really saying constellations control your fate. That's my...
It's a happenstance.
Yes. Correct. And Miriam, last question. That's a very interesting question. How would you book the money that you pay them? Is it tzedakah? They're not a qualified recipient as far as the CRA is concerned. Is this payment for work? I don't know. It's a fascinating problem. I mean, look, the general rule, you've been to enough of my classes, nothing that I say should be taken as practical guidance, either from a secular legal perspective or from a Jewish law perspective. We're just discussing, interesting topics. But that's a really interesting question. I don't know. So.
Depending on what it is, maybe it's a prepaid expense.
I don't know. I'm going to leave this to the tax people to work out because I don't know. But I think it's a good question. So thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. And next week, God willing, Rabbi Metzger is going to be speaking. He will be talking about billing for unproductive time beyond the accountant's control. There's Rabbi Metzger. He has now made himself live, so you can see him. And that should be a very interesting discussion as well. So hopefully you'll be back next week. Thank you very, very much.
Be
well.
Take care, be well, everybody.
Good to see you.